Good morning. We're delighted to welcome students from Randolph High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming and thank you for standing. You may be seated. The high school students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, then they are sent materials relating to the case. They come and hear oral argument, and after the second case, they will meet with a justice assigned for the day to meet with the students. The discussion at that time will be about the procedures of the court in taking, hearing, citing, and then publishing opinions, not about the substantive issues involved. Everyone is invited to attend that session with the students. This is an award-winning program, and we are very proud of the thousands of students who have come to learn about the judicial system in Wisconsin. Justice today, who will meet with the students at lunch, is Justice Patience Robitsack. Let me introduce the entire court to you. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left is the hand-waving Justice Patience Robitsack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. That's the lineup for this case, and now we'll hear from the hitters, namely the lawyers who will argue the case. And the first case we have today is 2013 AP 127, C.R. State versus Raheem Moore. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Raheem Moore, is Eileen A. Hirsch, who's assistant state public defender. She will have 25 minutes. Then we will hear from Assistant Attorney General Daniel J. O'Brien, and he will have 30 minutes. And then Ms. Hirsch will have an additional 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hirsch.
I am Eileen Hirsch, and I represent Raheem Moore. For more than 65 years, the United States Supreme Court has consistently held, has consistently held that children require special protections when they are interrogated by police in custody. They are unusually susceptible to giving involuntary statements and even to falsely confessing to crimes they did not commit. 9 years ago in State versus Jarrell C.J., this court agreed. It recognized that special caution must be exercised in determining whether a juvenile's in-custody admission is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, particularly when the questioning is prolonged or when it is done in the absence of a parent or friendly adult. The court unanimously held in Jarrell C.J. that his admission was not voluntary. The Jarrell C.J. majority also required recording of juvenile in custody interrogations, and the legislature promptly passed a law enacting that decision. Today, both aspects of the Jarrell C.J. case are before this court. Was Raheem's admission knowing, intelligent, and voluntary under the totality of the circumstances? And did Raheem refuse to respond or cooperate unless the recorder was turned off? We ask the court to reaffirm, clarify, and apply the principles recognized in Jarrell C.J. in the context of this case. I'd like to start with voluntariness because I think it provides a helpful framework for the recording question that we'll also talk about today. It is a fact-based determination always, and no two cases are exactly alike, but the similarities between this case and Jarrell C.J., I believe, are remarkable. Both of them were in eighth grade. Raheem was just 3.5 months older than Jarrell, very much the same age. Both of those factors weighed against voluntariness in the Jarrell case. Raheem had a lesser intellectual capacity than Jarrell did. Now, there's been some question about this in the briefs, but the fact is that four different psychologists who interviewed Raheem and evaluated Raheem over a three-year period all agreed that his intelligence was in the borderline range of intelligence. That's lower than low average, which was Jarrell's IQ. His IQ was 84, Raheem's is 73, and it's just above the level of mental retardation or a cognitive disability. It puts him in the bottom 3% of juveniles his age in terms of intellectual capacity. Now, Dr. Collins testified that on a previous achievement test, Raheem told her that he hadn't tried his best. But even Dr. Collins, in her testimony in that hearing, twice said that Raheem was in the borderline range of intellectual capacity. And if you read his statements, if you just go through the interrogation transcript and read his statements, you'll see that he's not particularly articulate or well-spoken. He also had a disability, and this is uncontested. Again, all four psychologists agreed that he had a long history of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. That's very relevant in the setting of prolonged questioning in custody. Again, all of these characteristics would weigh against a finding of voluntariness, even more so than Jarrell's in terms of the intellectual capacity and the disability. Jarrell didn't have those. Like Jarrell, Raheem had a very poor understanding of his Miranda rights. Now, again, there was some question about this in the briefs, but the bottom line is that when he was asked to explain in his own words the right to stop questioning and ask for a lawyer, he said, "If I'm talking to you all, then I don't have to, then don't want to say no more. I can just don't say nothing." Didn't explain the right to have an attorney. There's no suggestion that he understands the right to have an attorney, which was the right he was asked to explain. And it's an inadequate explanation of the right to remain silent, because as we know, a person in custody has to actually ask for the questioning to stop and say that they want to remain silent. The next line was spoken by a police officer, not by Raheem, the wonderful explanation.
That you're saying is an error in the transcript.
It's an error in the transcript, and of course, the best evidence was the recording, which is in the record. And you can tell very easily from listening to the recording that that was a police officer. I have to say it never occurred to me that that was Raheem because the language is that of a police officer, not Raheem. But it clearly is the officer.
Was there any correction of that transcript?
Pardon?
Was there any correction?
There never
the
was. I don't think anyone noticed it really until the state argued it in this court. I mean, I know that I read the transcript repeatedly and never thought that Raheem had said that. I didn't notice the attribution to the wrong person. I think there's a few other errors in the transcripts. These are never quite perfect, but that one's probably the big one. Now, like Jarrell, Raheem had two prior arrests. In the Jarrell case, the court found that that did not weigh in favor of voluntariness, the two prior arrests, because it found that in cases where prior history had weighed in favor of voluntariness, the juveniles had extensive police contacts, quite extensive, 19 arrests, been in corrections, etc. In this case, we have the same two as Jarrell, and the only difference is that Raheem had been adjudicated delinquent and Jarrell had not. That's not particularly helpful in this situation, again, because Raheem was not going to be charged in juvenile court. He was going to be charged in adult court because this was a homicide. The state and the Court of Appeals, to some extent, argued some evidence of sophistication. I would submit that lying to an authority figure is not evidence of sophistication. We all know that five-year-olds do it when they're asked who broke the lamp in the house. It's not particularly sophisticated. The story he made up about Javonte is a really interesting fact, I think, because in this case, that shows his suggestibility. What happened early in the first interrogation is that the police officer showed him some pictures and asked him if he recognized the people in pictures. He identified Ronald Franklin, and then he said he didn't recognize the person in the next picture. And a police officer said, "Do you know somebody named Javonte?" And he said, well, he knew a Javonte, but that wasn't the picture he knew. And so when he later makes up this story about doing a robbery with Javonte, he had actually gotten that idea from the police officer. And later, when the police asked him, after he eventually identified Reynard Franklin as the person who robbed the victim, he asked, the police said, "Where'd you get this Javonte?" And he said, "That other guy told me." That other guy meaning the police officer. So this was actually sort of evidence of what we talk about in false confession cases, that police unknowingly feed information in these interrogations, which defendants, and particularly juveniles who are highly susceptible to suggestibility, will pick up on. He used that phrase, party to a crime, but what we know is that he described that as being with him, which is really not the definition of a party to a crime. And so I think when you look at him, he is a very susceptible child who is just a 100 days or so older than Jarrell, but actually has fewer resources and abilities to deal with the pressures of police questioning. And then, as Jarrell says, we look at the pressures placed on this juvenile by the questioning, and we see that, first of all, there was prolonged custody. This is a very important factor. It's raised repeatedly, and including in the Miranda case, where they talk about long periods of incommunicado custody. In this case, Rahim was held for a total of almost 12 hours, more than 11 hours, in police custody from 12:05, just after noon, until almost midnight. He was interrogated during that period of time for 5.5 hours. The 5.5 hours is the same as Jarrell's. His length of custody is much longer than Jarrell's, which was about 7.5 hours. And again, if this court is going to provide a consistent message, it has to remember that Jarrell, those numbers, 7.5 hours in custody, 5.5 hours of interrogation, were found to be strong evidence that this was not a voluntary statement, admission. The other factor, and I want to talk about this factor a little bit, is the absence or presence of a parent. In preparing for this argument, I went back and looked at these cases and thought about this a little bit, because I've come to the recognition that the relevant question here, the question that's been recognized through federal legislation for years, and also in this court, is the question is simply the presence or absence of a parent.
Are you asking for a per se rule like the amicus?
I'm not. But I am asking for what the amicus suggested as their second option, which I just want to explain why a little bit on that. The question of why there's not a parent or other friendly adult or counsel there is really a secondary question. But if you go back and you look at Haley versus Ohio, 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court found that in that case, the fact that there was no friend stood at the side of this 15-year-old boy during questioning was a very strong factor weighing against voluntariness. There was no mention in Haley of whether he'd ever requested a parent or why the parent wasn't there, but the presence or absence was the factor. You go to Gallegos versus Colorado, a 1962, I think, U.S. Supreme Court case, and the prosecution in that case argued, look, we told him about his right to counsel, but he never asked for a lawyer and he never asked for a parent, and the court was just unconcerned about that. They didn't care. They said the failure to send for his parents, along with his long detention and a few other factors it mentioned, caused this to be an involuntary admission. In JDB, the most recent case in the U.S. Supreme Court, in 2011 case, the court very briefly discussed involuntary admissions, and in their brief statement of facts about that was a question of custody. In their very brief statement of facts, they twice noticed and said that he was questioned in the absence of his grandmother, who was his guardian. Nobody made any attempt to call his grandmother, and JDB didn't ask. And then you go to Hardaway, the Seventh Circuit case cited in the brief, In that case, the police had actually offered to take Hardaway's father to the police station with them, and he didn't for some reason. But that didn't matter. They still found that the absence of a parent or friendly adult was a strong factor weighing against voluntariness. And then in this court, Ontario, we had a clearly voluntary confession, no question about that. The question was that per se rule. But they defined the rule, the question is, whether a confession made without the presence of a parent or custodian must automatically be excluded. Now, I think what happened in Jarrell J., because he had asked for a lawyer for his parents to be there, is that what's happened since then, and it happened in this case, is that the police and the court read Jarrell J. to say, only if they ask for a parent and the police turn them down, does that weigh against voluntariness.
Well, didn't Jarrell have the specific language admonishing or encouraging law enforcement to follow the statute? And that statute provides in Jarrell that law enforcement must, upon apprehension of a juvenile, immediately contact the parents. I think that statute is 938.192, referenced in paragraph 43 of Jarrell.
That's correct.
So
exactly.
So how can Jarrell be interpreted that way if paragraph 43 and then the footnote sets forth that statute?
I wish I could answer that question. And, you know, the same statute was cited in Ontario in 1984. But you can see in this case that both police said, if he didn't ask for a parent, I didn't call one. And the court said, well, failure, you know, he didn't ask for a parent, so that's not a factor. And so I think this court needs to clarify. It needs to go back to those cases and once again clarify. And I would suggest this is where the amicus brief is important, is to say specifically that the absence of a parent alone, the phrase is parent, counsel, or friendly adult, alone, is a factor weighing heavily against voluntariness. And then saying that police, in order to make sure that happens, because it hasn't, even though there was the warning in Jarrell in Ontario in 84 and Jarrell in 2005, is to say what police have to do to meet their burden of showing that they tried to get a parent there is to put it on the record, that they called the parent, they gave them an opportunity to talk to their child, they asked them if they wanted to talk to their child, and that they also told the child and offered the child an opportunity to talk to their parents. I think that twice this court has heavily admonished lower courts and law enforcement that failure to have a parent present is strong evidence of coercion. Twice, the courts have not understood that message. And I know from this case and from others that they've narrowed that message to the question of whether the child asked for his parent to be present. Now, we've recognized in Miranda and other cases that unless you tell them they have a right to have their parent present, most aren't going to know to ask. That's same as the right to counsel. That's why we tell them they have a right to counsel. But this case, no mention was made of a parent. Police had talked to his dad sometime that day, but we don't know when. And we don't know if they said anything at all about whether he could come down and talk with his child. And we know from the record that they never told Rahim that if he wanted to talk to his dad before or during questioning, he could do that. And so I think I'm asking the court today to clarify that, to make that more clear. Unless you have a question, Justice Prosser, I just want to mention the other strong evidence that weighs against voluntariness in this case is the myriad of tactics used by the police during their questioning. And again, Jarrell J. talked about one of them, which was continually cutting off his denials. it found that that was evidence that could certainly get a juvenile to falsely confess to a crime or involuntarily admit a crime. We have all of that in this case. I counted 20 times in the first 2.5 hours of questioning where he said he didn't do it and the police told him he did. They also used techniques in this case, including, I think, really feeding on his fear of Ronald Franklin by telling him that Ronald Franklin was in the next room. They did many minimization and maximization scenarios. They said, you know, we think maybe it was just an accident, but if you don't talk to us and tell us what was in your mind, then the DA is going to think you're a boy with no conscience, that there'll be no mercy for you. We think you're a nice boy and should have a second chance, but unless you tell us, there'll be no mercy for you. They were very imaginative in all of their accident scenarios.
All of which have been held legal tactics in cases.
Absolutely. And they have been held to be legal, as is lying, a legal tactic. But the question is not whether it's legal or not. And there was some analysis of that in the state's brief suggesting, well, if it wasn't illegal, it's okay. But the clear analysis, it's in not just in Jarrell CJ, but in State versus Hoppe, is that you look at suggestive and coercive tactics, not just illegal tactics. Illegal is one thing, but suggestive and coercive tactics weighed against the susceptibility of the person who is subject to the interrogation. And I'm not saying any of these tactics are by themselves illegal, but they are coercive. And the courts have repeatedly recognized that when you have prolonged questioning in the absence of a parent and pressures put on by police questioning tactics, that that's strong evidence that the admission made at the end of that process is not a voluntary admission.
I'm kind of interested. There is the reference to contacting parents. Let's put that aside for a minute. When you have a minor, a juvenile, who is suspected of a very serious crime and has all the deficiencies that you have outlined, how do police go about getting a confession in your view? I mean, could you switch roles for a minute and say, what would you do to get a lawful confession, a voluntary confession, from someone who has shot someone to death?
Well, let me just say that I have two answers to that. First of all, I'm not sure he actually did shoot somebody to death. I think he didn't. I'm going to put that on first.
So it's allegedly shot.
Alleged to have shot. So I'll take that. But I actually believe that was a false confession. And secondly, I just want to, as part of that, I want to say, police don't have to have a confession in every case. They can simply put together the evidence that makes the case. And they often do that. That's the preferred method of proving a case, is to have all the evidence together. But if you are a police officer and you want to get a confession from Rahim, I think the first step is really to call his dad and ask his dad to come down there and talk with him and to sit in on the interrogation. I really believe that's the first step. The second step is to really slowly go through and talk about Miranda rights and to ask him to I think people were very impressed in this case that the police officer actually asked an open-ended question and instead of just the usual yes or no, do you understand? But they didn't listen to the answer. And they didn't come back and go through that with him and explain it to him. And so I think, and I have seen cases, I've read cases in which police officers have really had a conversation with the juvenile about their Miranda rights. I think those are the first two steps. And then I think you just can't do it that long. I mean, I just don't think you can go on as long as they went on to keep him in custody all of that time. So I think, you know, maybe they don't get an admission from him, but I think that if they're going to get an admission, it needs to be done, and I think they might have got an admission from him to some extent, to some part of this, if they had brought in his dad and given some breaks and allowed him to walk around a little bit with his dad, you know, have some conversations about this, and made sure that this was really a conversation with him in which he knew that he had a choice whether to talk with them or not.
Well, why don't you say that under 938.19 2, it says, shall notify. And it wasn't done. And therefore, it's mandatory. And what's the remedy for not adhering to a mandatory provision?
Yeah, it actually makes me think that was the illegal tactic the police used, was not notifying his parent. I don't know what the remedy is for that, unless we say, I guess we're getting very close to the per se rule. And you know, I have argued in the past for the per se rule. I believe in the per se rule. If that's the only way to enforce Section 938.19, parents 2, maybe that's what this court has to do.
Well, the question is, what did the legislature intend?
You know, I think the weakness in that argument is that the legislature intended that the parent, well, actually what the legislature intended is the parent could come down to the police station and be with their child. I think that's what they intended. Maybe not for purposes of interrogation, but for purposes of being a support and assistance and hopefully being able to take them home.
That statute covers custody.
Right. And so I think it's about taking them home, having a conversation about that. But there is certainly an aspect of that, that the parent could then come down to the police station and support their child.
Okay. And your orange light is on, and you've gotten an argument about knowing intelligent voluntary, KIV, as we say here. But isn't, you know, that's a fact-intensive matter. We don't ordinarily take that kind of case. Isn't the issue here about the statute and the refusal, whether this was a refusal under the statute?
That's exactly correct. That's the issue that I petitioned on, and it was the lead issue in my first brief. And this is the problem with knowing intelligent and voluntary, is that you can get carried away in the facts of these cases.
Can you add to your minutes not to be carried away?
Can you add to your discussion the applicability of that statute in light of this being an adult charge?
I'll try to do that in 5 minutes. Okay.
It's important.
I'll do this very briefly in 5 minutes. The statute is, there's clear legislative intent here, that when Jarrell J. was decided by this court, the legislature was already in the process of putting together a bill making it the policy of the state to record interrogations for adults suspected of felonies. And what they did then is they added all of the Supreme Court, and they said their intent was to codify the Supreme Court's decision in Jarrell J. So they put into 938.195 the requirement that there be recording, and then 938.195 says except for the exceptions under 938.31.3. And you go to those exceptions, and the first one listed there is the refusal to respond or cooperate. And my argument on that is very simple. When you look at the words he used, he did ask the first time. There were two times here. He specifically asked for the first time. He said something like, can you turn that thing off, or are you willing to turn that thing off? And once they figured out that the thing was the recorder, they talked him out of it in less than a minute. When you read that or listen to it on the tape, it's less than a minute. They go through more questioning, they have a break, and then the officer says, do you mind if I take notes? And what Raheem says is, you mean like talk on there? Now, to me, that's a question about what do you mean taking notes? How are you going to do that? But then the officer comes back and says, oh, do you want me to turn off the recorder? So he apparently interpreted that a different way. I don't understand. But that happens. And then he says yes. So that to me is, I think under statutory language, that's a choice. When given a choice, whether he wants the recorder on or not, he says, no, turn it off. That's what happened in this case. The legislative exception is much narrower than that. And it is that they refuse to respond or cooperate. That word refuse is important because it implies a very narrow exception to the recording requirement. The legislature could have easily said, if they ask to have it off, if they prefer to have it off, any of those that language, but they didn't. They made it a narrow exception, in part because Jarrell J. said there shall be recording in every case without exception when it's at the place of detention. So the legislature said, we need something, a little bit of wiggle room here, so we're just going to make it when they refuse. That was the concern. So my argument on that is the court should construe refuse in the way that it was meant according to the plain language of the statute. It was meant to be a narrow exception. It should be interpreted as a narrow exception. And my other brief point on that is that there's this issue of making a clear rule for police officers so that it's a rule they can follow. And if the court reads this whole discussion with him and makes this fact-based, intensive decision whether it's whether he actually, under these circumstances, refused or not, it's just going to make it murkier. And then you're going to have the question of whether, if they sit down at the beginning and the officer says to the child, "Do you want the recorder on or off?" and he says, "I'd prefer to have it off," is that a refusal? So I think my suggestion is that be construed narrowly, objectively, easy to follow. As to remedy, I'm sorry, this is taking a while. As to remedy, though, 938-195 and 938-31 are a pair. They refer to each other. They go back and forth with each other. And I think the legislature, and then you look at 968 and 972, which is the adult version. Those are two, they're matching pairs, but they don't match each other. There is no correlation between them except for the definition sections. And the truth is that you can't, under 972 in criminal court, you give a jury instruction that it's the policy of the state to record, and they can take that into consideration. Well, that would be wrong if the juvenile is in adult court. In adult court, it's the requirement that they record. Or for a juvenile, it's a requirement that they record. And so these pairs don't match. And I think the only explanation is that the legislature didn't think about that 1% of cases in which juveniles are tried in adult court.
And was this a mandatory trial in adult court because of the nature of the offense?
That's correct. But so, he was a juvenile. I think there's no question that he was a juvenile at the time, and that's applicable.
And there was a reverse waiver hearing.
There was a reverse waiver hearing. But it started in adult court, and they did not reverse waive it to juvenile court. The other way they end up there, of course,
but
is they start juvenile court waive.
When he was in the police station, he's 15 years old.
Right.
They think the charge is going to be homicide, right?
Right.
So do they treat him then as an adult in their questioning? And is that what applies to Kiv? Or what applies to Kiv is that he's a Jew, all of the factors you mentioned. Do you understand my question?
I think the answer is clearly that he is a juvenile at the time of that questioning under Jarrell C.J. The mandate was questioning, was interrogation for any person under 17, any juvenile. That's the definition used. You go through the federal cases. Haley was tried in adult court. Gallegos was tried in adult court. These were adult court cases, but they held that the juvenile, the age of the juvenile at the time of the interrogation, is what controlled. I think there's no question about that.
I have another one, but you can answer in your rebuttal.
Okay.
What applies anymore? Do we look at Jarrell, which you have done in your argument and in the briefs, or is Jarrell really dead law? And what now overcomes Jarrell is the statute. And so the statute governs, and we have to look to the language of the statute rather than to Jarrell. And they have not, the legislature did not adopt wholesale Jarrell, because it did put in the refuse provision. So that's my question. You can ponder it or not as you see fit.
But not now.
You want not me to now.
Wait? Okay.
Right. Mr. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General O'Brien, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. Just a couple of important points to make at the outset. First of all, the only issues before this court are whether the statements after 10:42 p.m. were voluntary.
Those are the only ones seeking to be suppressed.
That's been the argument all along in the trial court, court of appeals, and in this court, and that therefore everything up to that point, his statements up to that point, presumably were voluntary, because there's no challenge to those statements. Moreover, there's no challenge here to the Miranda waiver itself, and the state proved a prima facie valid Miranda waiver that the Court of Appeals held was an exceptional performance by police in getting him to understand. So there's no challenge to the validity of the Miranda waiver.
Was there anything inculpatory except at 10:42?
Well, I would suggest that he admitted the bulk of his involvement in the statements between 4:30 and 5:34 p.m. So that's when he made up the Gervonta story. Now, where he got the name Gervonta, whether it was something, a name that came into his head because a police officer was talking about it, matters little. But what's important is the details of his and Gervonta's roles that he described that are consistent throughout the confession. And when counsel says she believes it's a false confession, I believe the exact opposite, because the details he gave are strongly corroborated by what actually happened and what was observed at the scene and what he described later on at the scene when he went out with the police, again, long before 10:42 p.m., and described where he and Gervonta were that fit the physical details of what happened. And so what changed after 10:42 was only his role and the name of his cohort. His role was no longer as a lookout who expected to receive proceeds. And therefore, I think that's another factual dispute I have. He did understand party to a crime liability when he said, when the officer asked him, how are you involved? Well, like party to a crime. And then he said, Gervonta asked him to be a lookout, and then he expected to get some of the proceeds. They were hoping to get $30 or $40 out of this man. And so he had a very rudimentary understanding of participation in a robbery.
Counsel, as I recall, he then said, I was just with him. And reading that together made me think that although he used the term party to the crime, I was just with him, left doubt in my mind whether or not he thought there was any real culpability for being just with him vis-a-vis exposure to a murder charge.
He described what just with him meant, and he described that he was stood there as a lookout to make sure nobody came, and he expected to receive some of the proceeds, mm-hmm. which is enough to make anybody a party to a crime, to a robbery that turns into a murder. And so I think we have to be – so I guess the defense argument here is that while things were fairly – we didn't like the fact that this 15-year-old was questioned by police, but things were fairly cooperative up until 10:42, and then things became involuntary, and things became – and then the refusal issue arose. But again, I think we have to be careful, too, that to understand that there are significant differences, factual differences, between this case and Jarrell C.J. Factual difference number one is Jarrell C.J. testified at the suppression hearing. Raheem Moore did not. So we knew that that Jarrell C.J. said under oath that he asked police to contact his parents, and they said no. And Jarrell C.J. said he felt coerced and felt pressured. We don't know that. We don't know for sure that Raheem was in fact coerced here. We can speculate based on his age, based on his low intelligence. But unless you're going to rule as a matter of law that a 15-year-old with low intelligence cannot waive Miranda or cannot give a voluntary statement, absent his testimony saying, yeah, I was coerced. I really didn't understand Miranda. I really didn't. I made this all up. I didn't just make up Gervonta. I made up all the details. We don't know that.
The state asking that unless the juvenile testifies at suppression, that you can't find that he didn't understand?
Well, I if you look back at most of the vast majority of cases, including Haley v. Ohio and the Hardaway case in the Seventh Circuit, at this course, at the Jarrell C.J. itself, the juvenile testified, which gave great weight to the other factors in the analysis. In the absence of testimony, I don't know why a juvenile wouldn't testify if he, in fact, felt coerced. Just saying that, 15-year-olds normally have trouble understanding these concepts without any, again, as this court understands, this is a fact-specific issue. This is a, the child in Haley testified he was beaten by the police and his clothes had blood on him. You know, those kinds of factors are significant in the totality of the circumstances.
Maybe you couldn't put him on the stand because you don't know what he would ultimately say on the stand because of his IQ and his various other cognitive issues.
Well, I think it's interesting. When Rahim waived his right to testify at the suppression hearing, the trial judge made specific findings that he understood what his right was at that time and knowingly and voluntarily waived that right to testify. So I think I would hope that a defense attorney preparing a juvenile for testimony would deal with those kinds of issues and be able to put the child on. And if the child gives an inappropriate answer, be able to explain to the judge, well, this is just evidence of his lack of sophistication, lack of intellectual functioning.
Counsel, how important is it, this distinction that Jarrell testified and the defendant here did not, in view of, again, I refer to paragraph 43 of Jarrell. In that paragraph, reference was made to an older case, the Theault case, and it said in Jarrell, we choose to reaffirm our warning in Theault, 66 with second at 48, that the, quote, failure to call the parents for the purpose of depriving the juvenile of the opportunity to receive advice and counsel will be considered, quote, strong evidence that coercive tactics were used to eliminate the incriminating, to elicit, rather, the incriminating statement, unquote. And then Jarrell continues, here the juvenile was arrested at home. However, we remind law enforcement officials that Wisconsin law requires an, quote, immediate attempt, quote, to notify the parent when a juvenile is taken into custody, 938.19.2. So if it is as a, or can be argued, as a matter of law, strong evidence that coercive tactics were used, it's strong evidence under Theault, the added persuasiveness of a person actually testifying that I was coerced doesn't seem to be legally necessary. Can you respond to that, please?
Well, first of all, I think there is a significant difference in that in Jarrell testified that he kept asking for his parents and the cops said no, where Rahim never asked for his parents. More importantly, here, police did call the father. They did know. He was notified. And in fact, during the interview, Rahim was confronted with the fact that when he said that he's staying with his father, police said, well, your father hasn't seen you for several days. And then later on, during the three-hour break in the interview, after they come back after that three-hour break, when Rahim continues with the Javante story, the police say, your father said he's never met Javante, and Rahim said, yeah, he probably hasn't.
Let me, if I may, just to focus my question. 938.19 sub 2 says, when a juvenile is taken into physical custody, as provided in the section, the person taking the juvenile into custody shall immediately attempt to notify the parent, guardian, and legal custodian of the juvenile by the most practical means. I did not see in the record, and I just may have missed it. I know there was some reference to them talking to the father, but is it your position that the law enforcement complied with 938? The record reflects that law enforcement complied with the mandates of 938.19.2 in this case?
Well, circumstantially, it does. They got the father's cell phone number from Rahim at the outset of the interview. And somehow they contacted him, whether they went to the house or used that number to call him, they contacted him. Now, again, it's problematic here because the father didn't testify. And I would assume that if the father wasn't contacted or was contacted too late, he would have been there at the suppression hearing or would have submitted an affidavit to that effect. And so, again, we're dealing... So what we have in the record is that at some point the father was testified, told the police.
I'm sorry, was contacted.
Was contacted, I'm sorry. And then told the police that, no, my son hasn't been here for several days. And I think even at sentencing, there was some reference to the fact that Raheem was supposed to be at his father's house that day to help take his mother to a drug rehab center, where she was, and she was indisposed. So, circumstantially, is sufficient proof of compliance with 93819.
Mr. O'Brien, police officers can tell untruths to a person in custody whom they're questioning, right? They can say, John Smith, who's in the other room, has already said, you did it. It may be totally untrue. John Smith might not be in the room, and John Smith might not have said that. But it's a tactic used to persuade the person being questioned to talk, because if he should talk and put all the burden on John Smith. So why do you assume that the police were telling the truth at that time? Because this is a tactic that they could have used.
Because there's no proof to the contrary.
No.
That if the father contacted, or if the father didn't tell him.
But who's got the burden of proof here?
The state. And we proved circumstantially that he was contacted.
Well, you say you proved it because the police officer said that he contacted the father. But you've got a series of questions and the series of tactics used showing that they used perfectly legal methods to induce a confession. And one of the legal methods is, hey, you challenge a statement by saying you got evidence to the contrary. So I don't know that you can say that that's proof, but I can understand your circumstantial argument.
Well, and they talked throughout this. This is another major point that I need to make, and I don't want this to go by. The biggest difference between this case and Jarrell C.J. is that this interview was recorded. Jarrell's was not. Jarrell's was a credibility contest between the police and Jarrell. We don't even have a credibility contest because, again, Raheem didn't testify, but we do have the tape. And the trial judge listened to it. The Court of Appeals listened to it. And this court can, and I assume will, listen to it to determine for itself whether, under the totality of the circumstances,
but the tape,
Raheem's will was overborne.
The tape was not on at the first, at the confession. It was then surreptitiously put on afterwards. That good enough?
Well, we would argue that
I assume I have the facts.
It is good enough if, assuming that this was a refusal, that this was tantamount to a refusal, and then at that, after the unrecorded portion, the police surreptitiously turned it on. I would also suggest.
How does the state want the court to define or rule on what refusal means? Because that seems to be one of the key issues in this case. So whoever here has the opportunity to write this has to explain what refusal means and why the facts here fit refusal.
Well, right? I would suggest that guidance can be found in the implied consent law cases where the statute also requires a quote-unquote refusal to submit to a blood test. And it really is a fact-bound situation that you can't develop per se rules on what is there was not a refusal. At least in that context, you look at the totality of the circumstances. You look at whether, I point to this court's decision in Reiter, or R-E-I-T-T-E-R, at 227 West 2nd, and the subsequent court of appeals decision in Baratka, where this is really a very fact-specific, fact-intensive sort of issue. And you look to what the defendant, what the individual said and did, and you determine whether or not that's tantamount, that lack of cooperation or willingness to go without the recorder on, or whatever you want to call it, it arises to the level of an actual refusal to fully discuss the activities of the defendant and his cohort unless the thing was turned off.
Counsel, I understand the totality of the circumstances approach, but I think the question is what constitutes a refusal. It is the totality of the circumstances applied to what standard. Now, here, refusal is not specifically defined by the statute, but your opposing counsel on page 17 says it's kind of a plain meaning and uses Webster's Third New International Dictionary for the definition of what is a refusal. And the dictionary says it's defined as, quote, to show or express a positive unwillingness to do or comply with. Is that an acceptable definition of refusal for you? Do you agree with that?
It is the dictionary definition. I guess I would say, yeah, I think that, but that still doesn't get you to a clear black-letter law determination.
But that gives you the standard. Then you take the totality of circumstances and apply it to the standard of whether or not what was said shows or expresses a positive unwillingness to do or comply with. Is that the analytical approach then?
I certainly think that would give guidance. That along with the analysis in the drunk driving situation, the refusal cases, I think both that definition and the legal analysis in those cases is helpful in determining in each case whether the words and actions of the defendant were amounted to a quote-unquote refusal under the law. As far as this case is concerned, I think the trial judge did a very thorough job, and he wrestled with it, and he admitted that it was a tough call for him, but that he went through the entire interview, when the recorder was turned off, he looked at that interchange between the officers and Rahim, but also the previous interchange roughly a half hour earlier when Rahim specifically asked them to turn it off, and they had a give and take, and then he went ahead and with the recorder on, listening to the tape, you can decide for yourself whether what Rahim said when the officer said, mind if I take more notes, how that set off the following interchange, it's not clear, but the fact is, when asked, Rahim said, yeah, I really do want this off. I really am afraid of Renard. So let's turn it off as I asked earlier. And I think a reasonable trial judge, one trial judge might say, no, that's not enough, but I think a reasonable trial judge could find that, without being clearly erroneous, that is enough.
Well, counsel, that standard of review is de novo, not clearly erroneous, when you apply historical facts to a constitutional fact. So we're not doing any
deference. Well, that's not a constitutional fact.
Oh, whether or not it's voluntary?
No, refusal.
Oh, okay.
No, but you see, we have two different issues. That's what's complicating
what
this case.
Thank you for that. What is the intersection, then, between the refusal analysis that is interwoven with the voluntary analysis? I mean, where do you end up with that intersection and having a clear standard of review?
And I guess you'd have to ask my colleague here, because I'm not sure. I mean, the challenge all along, I think there's a dual challenge that after 1042, these statements should be suppressed. Number one, because the police violated the statute by not getting a proper refusal, and therefore the unrecorded and the surreptitiously recorded statement are suppressed whether or not they were voluntary, or two, everything after 1042 is involuntary, and the lack of a refusal, of the lack of a proper refusal, is another factor in the circumstantial, in the totality of the circumstances, showing that those statements thereafter were involuntary, because after all, part of them were supposedly in secret and that sort of thing. I assume that's what the argument is. And that's why there's no challenge to anything before then. Another point I want to make before we go any further is the length of the interrogation. Because, on the surface, the length of the interrogation In Jarrell CJ and here is very similar, a little over 5 hours. However, in Jarrell CJ, there were a few breaks, but the longest break was 20 minutes. Here, there were a total of almost 4 hours in breaks, including 1 3-hour break between 5:34 and 8:30, where Raheem was, he was not being questioned. And
was he always in the presence of a police officer?
I'm sorry?
Was he always in the presence of a police officer, including the breaks?
The record is not clear as to what happened, and I think the Court of Appeals pointed out that there certainly in the custody before the interview and the three-hour custody, it's not entirely clear where he was, whether he was taken to a cell, whether he was kept in the interview room, whether there was an officer always present, that's not clear. The fact is that the interrogation stopped. And then at 8:28, they resumed the interrogation. And then that was only for a few minutes. And then he agreed to go out to the scene with them and point out where things happened, where people were, what, how, who was where, that sort of, where, what street occurred, all this. And so they're at the scene. And then they go to McDonald's for dinner. And then they come back to the station. And then at 9:47, which is the second, I say the two most important points in the interview, are the 4:30 to 5:34 points where he initially, in great detail, admits his participation in this, although denies being the shooter, and makes up the Gervonta story, but everything else jives with what he later said. And then the 9:47 to 10:07 portion, the 20-minute portion, where for the first time he identifies Reynard Franklin as his cohort, still denying that. Raheem still denies he's the shooter, but says Reynard is. But all the details still fit with what he earlier said between 4:30 and 5:34. And then 9:40 and 10:07, he admits Reynard was involved. Then it's during the surreptitiously record, or the unrecorded and then surreptitiously recorded portion 10:42, where we would state would submit he truthfully admitted both their roles in this and truthfully admitted that Reynard gave him the gun, but he, Raheem, used it, then gave it back to Reynard. And as far as we know, Reynard still had it, and he doesn't know where it is. And then Raheem disposed of his own clothes. So, saying he was interviewed 5 hours is fine, but 5 hours separated by a three-hour break is a lot different than 5 hours separated by a 20-minute break. And
although Jarrell might be good law as to what are the factors to consider in Kiv, is it superseded by the statute?
I think the problem is the decision in Jarrell didn't contemplate the situation presented where, again, in Jarrell there was never a recording at all. And this court saw the need to say these must be recorded. Here we have a situation where police intended to record, wanted to record, and then Raheem either refused to talk any further about the truthful roles of him and Reynard unless the recorder was turned off, or even if it's not tantamount to a refusal, that at least he asked that it be turned off, and police in good faith, and I don't think there's any proof to the contrary, in good faith believed that he wanted it off and that they acceded to his request, but then thought, Jarrell CJ really requires us to keep this on. Why don't we surreptitiously record the rest of this? We're nervous about not getting this right. And I think that's more akin to the situation of a police recording that goes, hey, why the machine breaks down, which, the statute also covers. And even the situation of a refusal, which Jarrell CJ doesn't address.
There is not a challenge in this case to the constitutionality of the statute, which has this exception, however you define refusal, correct?
That's my understanding.
I'm a little bit lost about where there's a conflict with Jarrell and the statute. Maybe you could focus on that, because I didn't see a conflict till we all started talking here.
Well, Well, again, I don't think there's a conflict because...
Well, does Jarrell refer to refusal?
The statute comes out after Jarrell. So if Jarrell requires you have it, that there be no exception, then you're going to have to argue. Well, I don't know.
I think that's a good point. I mean, there are statutory exceptions, including refusal and including the machine malfunctioning. And there's a statutory provision that the interview is to be recorded even if the juvenile doesn't want it to be recorded. You can surreptitiously do it like they did here. None of those scenarios are necessarily contemplated by Jarrell C.J.
Right.
They may be very well consistent with it, but that's for another time that when those issues actually arise. And again, in this situation, I think we really do have a very different scenario where police really intended to comply with Jarrell C.J., and they recorded the bulk of this interview, basically all but whatever it was, 30 or 40 minutes of it, in attempting to comply with Jarrell C.J., then the issue becomes what happens if a juvenile clearly expresses the desire not to continue. He expresses the desire to continue talking, but not with the recorder on. Then what happens? That specific scenario is not necessarily contemplated by Jarrell C.J.
Counsel, one of the differences that's advanced between Jarrell and the subsequently enacted legislation is that Jarrell took the approach of this court can control what is admissible in court and use the language regarding what's admissible for the admissibility of this in court. Now, the subsequent legislation was a little different than that. The subsequent legislation made reference to a juvenile proceeding vis-a-vis the refusal. So you've got that difference. How, if at all, do you address that?
Well, you know, again, you have the they did provide a remedy in both situations. For the juvenile proceeding, they said it's to be suppressed. In the adult proceeding, they said as would be with an adult statement, it is the jury is to be told that the state wants these, requires these to be recorded, and you can take that into account in assessing the reliability of this confession. Now, I would suggest that, you know, I would suggest that Jarrell C.J. doesn't necessarily, this is this odd situation where you have a juvenile and adult court, and I don't think Jarrell contemplated that specific situation. Again, I mean, if the legislature is wrong, that's something that can be fixed with, you know, corrective legislation, or that the legislature felt that the remedy was sufficient to deal with it in adult court.
I need, if I may, help with this. And it's the very last paragraph of the concurrence. The last paragraph of the concurrence starts with, although I disagree with the majority that 938.31.3 exception applies here. And so both the majority and the concurrence focus really just on 938.31.3. And then the concurrence goes on to, without using the term harmless error, essentially, I think, very abbreviated harmless error. Two questions. Number one, do you agree that's an abbreviated harmless error that the concurrence is engaging in?
Yeah,
I think so. That's the way you argued it in your brief,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
But the more important second question is this, and that is you, although both majority and concurrence just focus on 938.31, in the context of you arguing harmless error in your brief, you bring in 972.115, which neither the majority nor concurrence decided the case on in the court.
But that's what the trial judge decided the case on.
I know, but in reading all this,
And the plain language says you get a jury instruction.
That's why I say I need help. The petition for review, we took the case as a 938.31 case, both the majority and the dissent, in concurrence, treat this as a 938 31 case. But your argument, as I understand it, is that this may really be a 972-115 case. By that number, I mean, hey, this is an adult proceeding with an adult remedy.
Well, and that ties into both it ties really more into the harmless error argument in that if this wasn't a refusal, if it didn't amount to a refusal, he asked to turn it off, but he really didn't refuse, then 972-115 applies. And in the context of the harmless error argument, if he gets a jury instruction but doesn't get suppression, that's a significant factor in determining whether he would have accepted the guilty plea or would have insisted on going to trial with that jury instruction, but also with the full confession in the record. I guess counsel is asking this court to overrule 972-115, in essence saying that it doesn't go far enough. But there's no developed argument on that point. How it should do so? Is it a separation of powers issue? Is the remedy inadequate? I mean, can the legislature devise a remedy, but this just wasn't enough, only a jury instruction? We don't know.
This wasn't a jury trial, was it?
No, it was a guilty plea.
That's right.
It was a 971-3110, right. Appeal with the right to litigate expression.
You think 972-115 applies anyway?
Pardon me?
You think 972-115 applies anyway?
In this situation, by its plain language. Okay. It specifically says if it's not recorded, you give it a jury instruction, whereas the juvenile counterpart.
There's no jury instruction here. It was a plea.
Right, but in the context of harmless error, okay, in evaluating whether he would have pled guilty,
okay,
knowing that all he gets is a jury instruction and not suppression of any of this confession, would he have pled guilty in a system
of the legislative remedy, whether jury trial or not, is you would get the jury instruction and the court would have to consider that in taking the plea.
I'm sorry?
The court would have, the trial court in taking the plea would have considered 972-115.
Well, I'm not sure that.
Okay.
It's only significant when you're at trial and the instruction gets in, or then the confession gets in. Then you tell the jury because it wasn't recorded, you can consider that in determining whether this is a reliable, believable confession.
Right. And the trial court has to decide whether it's a reliable, reasonable confession.
Well, no, that's a jury.
Suppression. There's no jury here. Okay.
Well, but a suppression hearing, the judge doesn't determine the truthfulness of it. The judge determines whether it's admissible under the U.S. Constitution.
All right. Under harmless error, as I read your brief, you have a different standard of harmless error. That is, would he have pled anyway? And the defendant has, as I read it, a slightly different way of applying harmless error.
Well, I think that we're governed by the Armstrong decision, which clearly holds that in this context, in the guilty plea context, the issue was whether the defendant would not have pled guilty and would have insisted on going to trial had this been suppressed. And I don't see any indication in this record that the defendant, and again, Rahim didn't testify. He didn't say, I would have insisted on going to trial had this, had these police not coerced me into giving this false statement.
Yeah. And on page 25, as I read the defendant's brief, it's whether or not the statement contributed to the conviction. That's a slightly different standard for harmless error.
Yeah, and that's the standard after a trial. I unless this court's going to overrule Armstrong and the many cases that have followed it since, you look at whether he in fact would have pled guilty is a reasonable probability. The Hill v. Lockhart standard, otherwise why are we here? If he would still have pled guilty, even if the statement gets knocked out, then why are we here? Then he basically gets, we're talking about automatic reversal on something that in hindsight doesn't matter. And again, we're only talking about what happened after 1042. And as I said, I see my red lights on, so unless there are more questions, but I'll just conclude by saying, again, the biggest difference between this case and Rahim is, and Jarrell CJ, is there was a recording here of everything up to 1040, from 2:49 to 1042, and everything from 1030 or 1040 onward. And this court can determine for itself whether, under the totality of the circumstances, Rahim's will was unconstitutionally overborne by police tactics. This court couldn't do that in Jarrell CJ. It can and should do so now, and the state submits. After doing so, it will find that the statement was voluntary, and it will also find that the trial judge's finding that Rahim did refuse to talk further about his and Reynard's involvement unless the recorder was turned off was not clearly erroneous.
Justice Prosser.
It really is not clear to me whether 938.31 applies to this case, in your view, or it doesn't. Could you clarify that?
No, 938.31 applies, we submit, it applies to juvenile delinquency proceedings by its plain language. In proceedings where the child is determined to be delinquent, I think is the statutory language, is something similar to that. And so that as the trial judge painstakingly analyzed, that puts us, because we're an adult court, that puts us under 972.115. That's the remedy, not the remedy provided at 938.
Okay. Well, let me just try this. We have a 15-year-old who commits a burglary and is not waived into adult court. There is no original jurisdiction in adult court. 938.31 applies, and any statements made have to square, have to be recording, and any statements have to square with the statute. But if it's the same person under the same circumstances being interviewed for a murder, first degree murder, you're saying that the same protections in this statute do not apply?
Well, again, I mean, I look at the both statutes provide a remedy for an improperly unrecorded statement, and they focus 938 focuses on delinquency proceedings. 972.115 focuses on adult trials. So we, you know, it's how the evidence is used at trial. And that, and so that's, now if the legislature is wrong, this court can tell it so. But that's where the focus is yes, this, both statutes require the statement to be recorded. They contemplate, then, but they provide different remedies in how the evidence is or is not to be used at trial. And so I would say, yeah, that the burglary suspect, his statement's suppressed under the plain language of 938, whatever it was with 31, where the adult, all adults, obviously, you get a jury instruction. This is the quirky case of a juvenile in adult court, but again, 972.115 talks about adult court and what happens during that trial, and that the remedy is the jury instruction telling the jury that this should have been recorded, it wasn't, you can take that into account, or, you know, paraphrasing. So that's, I guess that's the best I can answer that.
It seems to me your opposing counsel made a very effective argument that what the rules are that apply to adults are different from what the rules are that apply to juveniles, so that jury instruction would really be misleading.
Well, and again, I mean, again, we go to the plain language of the statute. Now, if the plain language, if this court feels that it contradicts what Jarrell CJ requires, then it can say so. I mean, but again, that only happens if you find that there was an insufficient refusal. And I also would suggest you don't need to address that Flaherty issue if you find it was harmless error, even if there was an insufficient refusal. I would suggest that just saying that it conflicts with Jurel CJ, then what do we do here? Should we leave it to the legislature to fix it? Does this court, in its supervisory capacity, overrule that provision as with respect to this situation? I just think that issue might be better addressed when it's more clearly presented and developed as to how it should go about, this court should go about doing that. Is there a separation of powers issue, all of that sort of thing, that really isn't developed here.
I understand you correctly, just so I'm not confused. You're not at all contesting that 938.195.2 requires the recording of a juvenile's interrogation when he's in custody, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that step you folks are in agreement on. And what you're saying is, well, we don't really need to be concerned about this refusal issue that comes up in 938.31, because 938.31 is a chapter that deals with proceedings that go on in juvenile court, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So you went then to the statute that the trial court applied because at the time the suppression motion came up, he was in adult court, not in juvenile court.
Correct.
Okay. So if he had been in juvenile court, then would you say that 938.31.3 C1 would be what we should be focusing on?
Correct.
Okay. Just so I understood. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, now my red light's completely out. It got burned out. Oh, it's back on.
We've got it taken care of, Mr. O'Brien.
Is there any more questions?
I'll conclude. Seated. Thank you.
I'm going to focus completely on the statute, and I want to begin with, there's really two questions. First of all, was this a refusal? On that issue, I think the legislation is consistent with the decision in Jurel CJ. Although Jurel CJ says no exceptions at one point during the decision, there is a footnote, and I can't tell you which one, that mentions that there might be some circumstances under which there's a reasonable decision that you, mostly they're referring to the recording equipment fails to work. So there is a footnote suggesting there may be exceptions, and I believe that the legislative enactment did try to incorporate what were reasonable exceptions under the footnote in Jurel CJ, and that the legislation is completely consistent with the case. And so I'm very comfortable with that. I'm also very comfortable if this court decides to use the refusal standards in the OWI cases, because those cases, it was very clear conduct of refusal. They didn't change the statute to say, well, if you ask somebody if they want to take a blood test, they get to choose. But they said, when he said he'd take the blood test, but he refused to put his arm out and he walked around and he refused to do this and that, That's conduct showing refusal, and I'm okay with that. That's clearly allowed under the statute. But it's still refusal. It's not giving somebody a choice, which is what happened here. And I think the court, that's consistent with both the language of the legislature and Jurel J., and that's not an issue. The remedy issue is more difficult, and I wish I had a simple solution for you, but I want to go through that because it's not just that 972.115 conflicts with Jurel J., it conflicts with Section 938.195. And I think we're clear that 195 has to control here. This was a 15-year-old at the time of the interrogation. And 938.195 says the law enforcement agency shall make the recording that's conducted at a place of detention unless a condition under 931.31.3c applies. So you have to go to 931.3c. That's where they send you. And then 931.3c says it's not admissible in these delinquency proceedings, referring back to the 938.195 requirement of a recording. And so those two statutes are absolutely hand in hand. I can tell you the context of this, just because of my knowledge, is that Chapter 938 applies to non-delinquency proceedings, too. It applies to ordinance violations, other kinds of offenses, and GIPS cases. So when they say delinquency proceedings, what they were trying to do was to distinguish it from civil cases in which that confession could come in. But that's not in the, in the record. That's my knowledge here. But the problem is 938 never refers you over to 960-68 or 972 except for a definition. And then you have this entirely parallel, different set of statutes in 968, which says in 968.073, it is the policy of this state to make a recording unless the good cause under 972.115 applies. And then the specific jury instruction is, it is the policy of this state to make a recording. And so there's no way you can jump in the statutes. They don't take you from 938.195 to 972.115. It just doesn't happen. And if the court actually read 972.115 and gave this jury instruction, it would be wrong. And then we'd be appealing that and saying, that's not the policy of the state, it's a requirement. And we'd be back here again. And so I wish there were an easy answer to this question, but the truth is, I think there's no way to get around this, is that the legislature created these two pairs of statutes not realizing it was leaving a gap. And in the sense of that gap, it's easy to say, well, the legislature should fix it, but you have a case in front of you right here that requires you to interpret this statute. And that, by the way, is de novo review. This is interpretation of a statute as applied to the facts of the case. There's no burden on Rahim here, by the way. There's no reason for him to testify. The burden is on the state to prove this, voluntariness, et cetera, and to prove refusal. And here, this court is faced with having to decide this case, and you ask yourself what rules of statutory construction apply. You look at, you have to read like statutes similarly. When you do that, you see that you have these pair of statutes over in 938, and then you have 968, 972. They don't match. And in the end, you have to ask yourself, what was the legislative intent? I don't think there's any other way to resolve it in this case. This is not plain language. It doesn't fit. I think you have to ask yourself, what was the intent? And the intent is clearly stated throughout the legislation. It is to effect the decision, to codify the decision in Jarrell J. The decision in Jarrell J was that if this is an unrecorded interrogation, it's not admissible in court, any court. And so I think that's how the court, it's the only way I can come up with to make an argument, to make a reasonable argument of statutory construction about how you construe this statute. And I don't think the court can just dodge it and say, well, the legislature should fix it, because you have a case in front of you that requires an interpretation.
Well, this case is a little bit more difficult than they just didn't record the confession. I mean, what about the counsel's argument that up until 1042, all the stuff that was recorded was just fine? When they went to the scene of the crime, he told them all the details that were there. What about that? That's recorded. We just leave that out of our consideration, or is that relevant to whether harmless error occurred here, if there was error?
Okay, so if we go to, I think it's not relevant to the issue of whether he refused to turn off the recorder. We agree on that. It certainly is on voluntariness, and I'm not giving that up. But on the issue of harmless error, this is a recent doctrine in this court, relatively recent doctrine, that you can use harmless error in a admission case, a plea case. And I think the question here, the question is, would he have entered this plea? Would he have gone to trial? You know, I think the practical question with asking whether he would have entered this plea and gone to trial is that this plea is very specific. This was a plea to a maximum, the DA arguing 25 years, a 25-year maximum sentence. If the evidence had not been admitted, the unrecorded portion of this interrogation and the follow-up were not admitted, then we would have a situation in which Rahim had admitted to being a, he said party to a crime, but being present during a crime. While the DA is negotiating this plea with Rahim, he's over here with the other co-defendant, who, by the way, is 2 years older and has an armed robbery conviction and has been to corrections. And he's offering him a plea of 15 years, 10 plus 5, 10 and 5 ES.
That, I don't think that really goes to harmless error in this case, counsel. I mean, what I'm concerned about is how and if we should make use of what he said up until 1042. Because that complied with the statute. That was recorded.
Well, that goes back to me, to voluntariness. And I do, I did limit the argument in this case to after 1042. I have to say that as I've prepared for this case, as I've discussed with my colleagues, I think the right decision is that if it was involuntary at 1042, it was involuntary earlier as well. Because really all those factors were in place. And the only one that wasn't in place was the length of questioning. And I have to say, I'm admitting here I made a mistake, really, I think, by arguing that.
Well, I don't know if it's a mistake. You try to put out your strongest argument to us, and we appreciate that, frankly. But other things can still bother us as we try to sort through.
Yeah, and this has bothered me. And when I go back and, for example, I read State versus Hoppy, that was three, that was the guy who was in the hospital, three separate days they went. The court didn't say, we're throwing out the third day, but not the first day. They threw the whole thing out. The case is all, that's also in Gallegos. Gallegos, he did a written confession after about 3 days, and the state said to the court, well, but he orally admitted right away, and the court said, no, the whole thing is involuntary and due process, and it violates due process. I think that we are, in some cases, in a new world now when we have these recordings, but it seems that the issue on voluntariness is that there was police overbearing, overreaching. It overrode his constitutional right to remain silent. And in that case, I think that it's a dangerous road to go down, and that's why I think I made a mistake, to start breaking it up and to say at, 4:49 it was still voluntary, but at 5:10 it wasn't. And so I am concerned about that, and I would not object if this court found that the entire statement was involuntary. But I think that there's difficulties, and this is a difficult case, both on the voluntariness issue and on the remedy, although I do think on the statutory issue, the court really has to go with the legislation. I think the only way to look at this is that the legislation missed that mark of that small percentage of cases where they're in adult court, and it has to go with the intent, which was non-admissibility in any court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both Ms. Hirsch and Mr. O'Brien for their arguments in State versus Moore and presenting the Jurel issue along with the statutes in a new fact situation we haven't faced before. And thank you for your briefs and for your argument. And that ends our hearing in 2013 AP 127 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Moore. The court will take a brief recess before it calls its second case for this morning. We are in recess.